Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, everybody. This is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. My producers are Patrick Antonetti and Sean Cherry. Two guests this week. First up, a regular on this podcast, John Orand, from the Sports Business Daily and Sports Business Journal, and we have a discussion on NFL viewership as we head to the almost the one-third part of the season, what we can extrapolate from the numbers, why the league is absolutely overjoyed at this point, even though the numbers are down. We go a little bit into NBA viewership, although I'm going to do a major podcast coming up in the next couple weeks on sports viewership overall, so I'll get a lot into the NBA on that one. And so John and I with some viewership talk, and then that's followed by Stan Van Gundy, the former coach, of course, in the NBA, now working as an excellent analyst for Turner Sports on their coverage of the NBA. Stan also does some stuff for NBA TV as well. And we get into Stan's experience in the bubble, what that was like, spending time with his brother. Jeff Van Gundy, of course, is the lead analyst on ABC's coverage and just finished up the NBA finals. And then Stan and I get into really what I thought was an excellent discussion just about being public, about the nexus of sports and politics and race and social justice. Stan Van Gundy is one of the most public people, certainly on his Twitter feed, when it comes to discussing these issues. And I was just curious about you know, why he's been so public, how his employer sees it, you know, just sort of how he thinks about that nexus, and that was a really interesting discussion. So, John Orand to start, and then Stan Van Gundy coming up on the Sports Media Podcast. All right, as I said at the top, John Orand is a sports media reporter for the Sports Business Daily and Journal, and he is kind enough to join me again. He's a regular on this. We're going to keep him pretty short today. No need to go so long with Orand. I'm sure he will be back over the next couple weeks. So, you know, we'll try to give you like 20 minutes or so of sports media talk. And this will not be dropping public relations names on this one, John. We're not going so deep in inside baseball.
No more PR name drops. I'm tired of getting the emails from those, Richard. No more.
This is will be very, very broad here. All right. So let's start with the NFL, John. People loved talking about NFL viewership. I apologize for laughing, but like I've told this to John privately, never in my lifetime did I think sports viewership numbers would become politicized. But they have. But in this case, 4 weeks in, NFL viewership is down 10% based on the reporting and data from your colleague Austin Karp. That's before the Thursday Bucks game. So that number may actually be a little bit even further down as we're talking here. It could be like 9%, 8%. As John and I are taping, we don't have the results of week 5 Sunday yet. And so we'll see how this all shakes out. But so John, here's my thought here. Television executives have told you and others that like they are really pleased by the fact that the league is only down 10%. And I'll be honest, like I think a lot of times, like, you know, people spin the hell out of stuff. But in this case, like I actually think that is a fair assessment, given the landscape, given all the sports competition, given the crazy amount of news that exists and how much cable news is up. I think if you're the NFL, the most powerful entertainment medium right now that exists on linear television, being down only 10%, I think that's a win. How do you see it?
I think it's a huge win. And I think that comparing ratings for the NBA. I mean, you're comparing in October versus June. You're comparing in October against college football, the NFL, and Major League Baseball playoffs, including the Yankees in there, versus June, which is going up against regular season baseball. I just don't think any comparison works this year. I don't think that we're going to have a real comparison until probably 2022. But I do think that there are certain things that are really unique about the TV ratings numbers that are coming out now, because all sports are playing, and you're able to see, for me, how dominant. We've always known the NFL was the highest rated. Look, the Super Bowl, what else gets 100 million viewers out there? But here, we're actually seeing how dominant the NFL is up against, you know, they had a Sunday night, a regular season Sunday night football game against the NBA Finals and destroyed it. I mean, it is so far ahead of where the NBA is. It is so far ahead of where MLB is. It's so far ahead of where the NHL is. It's just a different TV programming stratosphere. I think that's been particularly interesting to take a look at.
100% agree. I mean, honestly, there's NFL content, and then like just drop down, and then have a discussion on everything else. One of the charts that was in Sports Business Daily, that it's not like I didn't know this, but when you see it in chart form, John, you're like, holy shit, that is impressive. 13 of the top 15 broadcasts since March are NFL-related, NFL games. The only two, correct me if I'm wrong, by the way, I don't think I'm wrong here. The only two that beat it, the vice presidential debate and the presidential debate. So 13 of the top 15 broadcasts on television since the pandemic started, NFL programming. I mean, that is remarkable, correct?
Not just NFL programming, regular season games.
Regular
for
season
NFL
games,
programming.
Right.
And that's also what's instructive about that. It's all of TV. So this trend that we've seen happening over the past decade, maybe a little less, live sports, live news, it really is what matters. So people can jump up and down, and I know we're going to talk about a little bit about the NBA numbers, but the NBA is still bringing in more than any entertainment programming out there right now. It's live sports, live news matters. So despite the viewership dropbacks that we've seen in the NBA and in the NHL, it's still, TV networks still view that as such powerful programming, and they're going to be fine.
There was something that you had in one of those pieces that I thought was really interesting. I think it was probably your newsletter, where you said, or you reported, that the NFL's top media executive, Brian Rollup, sent a memo to teams telling them not to be overly concerned about ratings. I found that as a really good piece of reporting there, unless that was public, but I don't think it was. But that's really interesting to me, because obviously the NFL is very, very heightened when it comes to viewership. All of these leagues are. I mean, all of these public relations departments, they know what the viewership is. They'll reach out to reporters to try to spin. But I found that interesting, John, that memo went to teams basically saying, hey, we're in an unprecedented time here. Don't freak out if one of our windows is down 15, 20%.
Yeah, and I think part of it is because everybody's going nuts. I mean, I've been writing about TV ratings, and it's been getting so many clicks on our website. I mean, people are so thirsty for this now, for any kind of information on it. And I think that's sort of what got the NFL to send out that memo. But like in a normal world with no pandemic and the sports schedule being as it usually is, the NFL was looking at taking a big step back viewership-wise this season because it's lost viewers. It's seen its viewers drop. Every presidential election going back probably the last 5-6 elections, I don't have the actual stat in front of me, but that was part of the message that Rollup was giving. Like, we were expecting a drop. The drop has come, and the drop has come not just because of that, but also because of all the different competition. So the NFL is really hurting the NBA numbers and the NHL numbers. But the NHL numbers and the NBA numbers are taking viewership away from the NFL too, just not as much. So they're just getting hurt from different areas. I think being down 10% is something I know that they're pretty happy with, and I think it's a pretty good number for them.
So let's talk about this. We are in a hyper news cycle. It's not just another presidential election. It's an insane hyper news cycle, which has really kind of lasted, in all honesty, for the last 3.5 years or so. Is there any way? Let me phrase that better. What is your sort of best guess over the next 2 months? Because while the election is, as we tape this, you know, in less than a month, the post-election news, I don't think is gonna subside. So my sense, John, would be that the cable news numbers from now until whenever, you know, December or so, are just gonna be astronomical. I wouldn't even begin to predict what the news of the country will be. So if you just extrapolate that further, I would think that that's going to overshadow almost everything, and any sports outside of the NFL that comes in that time frame is going to be impacted by this. You agree?
Potentially, I think everything depends on the unknowable right now, which is, will we know on November 3rd who the next president of the United States is? If we do know that, then it should be good for the NFL. I mean, the NFL should see a resurgence going forward. If we don't know that, all bets are off. I mean, then we're entering territory that you don't have any comps at all to where you say, oh, well, back in 2000, you know, two thousand or 2004, something happened. One other thing to keep in mind is that 4 years ago, that was Trump's first go at the White House, and the news networks saw such a huge rise in viewership, and the NFL during that election cycle was down like 14%. Well, this year they're only down 10%, so they're actually doing better this year, and so. Part of that might be, you know, the lack of undecided voters. Like people have, I know so many people that have already voted. I know people that have made up their mind 4 years ago about who they're going to vote for in this election. So that may play into a part too, where they're not going into to watch as much cable news as they had in the past. So it's unknowable, but I think that there are some signs suggesting that that college football and the NFL are going to fare okay in the next couple of months.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, oh, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to do very quickly NBA viewership. We don't have the numbers for the final game, the clinching game six, but it happened on a Sunday night. It went against Seattle, Minnesota in the NFL, which I assume will win the night. And it also went against game one of the Rays versus the Astros. I would assume that game, compared to another league championship series, is going to tank. But, you know, we'll see when that viewership comes out. The larger point is, John, that the NBA Finals will be down significantly in terms of viewership. Whether that number is 40% or 50%, it's going to be down for the series. You can't spin it. Those are not good ratings. LeBron James is in the finals. Even if we're in a pandemic, even if we're in uncharted waters, those were not expected numbers. Those were not good numbers. Here's the most most important thing. And in a couple weeks, I'm going to do a really long sports viewership podcast with some experts, and we'll really analyze this. No offense, John, you're not part of that. So my thought is, and I think both, this is where me and you do not always agree on viewership, but I am positive me and you agree on this. It is never one factor. It is always multiple factors. It's television factors. It's competition factors. Do I think there are some people who are turned off by the politics and social justice? Of course. Do I think it's a statistically large swath? No, I do not. Others do. So do you have at least some top line thoughts, John, as to NBA viewership in the bubble and the numbers that we ultimately saw out of it. And if I had to take a guess, you know, maybe that Sunday night game finishes with like 9 million viewers or something like that, where obviously in other clinching games, we've seen like 18 million, 17 million, 19 million.
Yeah, so I'm going to try to do a little bit of spin on this because it is just so hard. The NBA playoffs and the NBA finals are not held in October. There's a different there's a way that most sports viewers, especially casual sports viewers, attack the sports calendar. And right now, as it's getting cooler out, you know, you have college football, you have Major League Baseball playoffs, and you have the NFL. And if anything, you have a couple of regular season basketball games. So I just think that there's so much competition right now. There's competition from news, as we've said, from the NFL, that it is so hard to take a look at the NBA numbers and really decide how or why anything matters right now. I think it's going to take next year is going to be an abbreviated season, almost certainly. It's going to take another year until we get an actual comp. That said, the numbers going into the bubble, the numbers going into the pandemic for the NBA were miserable this year. They were down. Everything was down really significantly, and there are a lot of reasons for that. I mean, one is the Lakers are a primo team, but they're a West Coast based team. So having sort of the Heat have proved to be a fun team. The Celtics are a fun team, but they didn't show that in the regular season. It took a while for people to get to know them. Having your best teams out west does not translate to great ratings for various leagues. There needs to be a little bit more parity, as there has been in the past. And having LeBron in Miami or having LeBron in Cleveland, just giving you that East Coast window of a guaranteed ratings getter is so important. Having cord cutting is with cable hurts the NBA completely. I mean, the NBA has a really good demos, young, male, and those are the ones that are cutting the cord. Those are the ones that are not watching full games and they're watching elsewhere. I mean, I can do this. I can go. We can come up with a list of 10 reasons for why the ratings were down. But it is something that's very concerning to the NBA. It's something that they're going to be taking a look at. But the numbers coming out of the bubble, like, nobody knew what to expect them to be. They're probably lower than I would have predicted. But yeah, I don't think they really matter.
That's interesting. Like, again, I think. Yeah, I didn't expect you to do the NBA spin. So now after you throw me off here, everything you said, like, to me is correct. And again, I don't want to go so deep into this because I'm really going to do like an hour plus podcast on sports viewership. But they have a viewership problem at the moment, and they can't ignore that. And some of the things that caused the viewership problem, I think, are a little bit self-inflicted, including their absolutely fucking shitty response to China. That said, if you're going to be honest and if you're going to do good faith, I do agree with John. This is such an outlier year. You can't do specific apples to apples comparisons on everything. And there are real things that are on court things that I think if they change, I think can be a jump. I'll tell you one thing, John, that I've always said this. I talked to Austin Karp and Anthony Krupe about this, and I know you'll appreciate it because you're someone who loves to look at sort of local ratings to get a better sense of what's going on nationally. The NBA is absolutely fucking killed by the fact that the Knicks and the Bulls have sucked for a long time. They get nothing out of New York and Chicago, both in terms of those local teams being prominent on national broadcast as well as those local markets just being into basketball. So I've always thought that if one of those two teams could just get hot and be a real factor, I think it game changes the national ratings. And so, again, I don't know this to be the case, but this will be the last one I ask you on, and then we'll move to our last topic. Do you think if Brooklyn somehow becomes like a really, really great team and like sort of a really interesting team with Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, could they be like the East Coast flagship that the league really, really needs especially in these early windows at like 7:30, 8 o'clock to get a good rating? Or is Brooklyn always going to be thought of as sort of like a, you know, like the way the Devils are thought of viewership wise in hockey? Like, yeah, they're New York, but they're not quote unquote the Knicks.
Or a couple of things on that. One is, you're so right about the lack of an NBA team that's been in New York, and that is been a problem for the NBA for how long now, right?
Forever.
In fact, going back to the NFL, another reason that they should be so happy about this is the Jets and Giants ratings locally are doing miserably right now, and that's just bringing down the number one market. That's bringing down everything else. So the NFL ratings in Los Angeles, same thing. And that's the fact that that they're only down 10%, given that on top of everything else, is pretty huge. As for the one thing about the NBA is that, you know, they do well locally. It's not like baseball that does great locally. Basketball still has a national following, and basketball still is a star-driven league, and people will tune in to see, you know, the Rockets. You know, I play. They tune in to see Oklahoma City. I think they'll tune in to see the Clippers play this season. I think they'll tune in to see the Nets with Kyrie and Durant. I don't think that a Nets championship would galvanize ratings in New York the way a Knicks championship would.
Yeah, great.
For the next several years, I think that, you know, brands matter. I think the Lakers winning is so much bigger in LA than the Clippers winning. Even though the Clippers might get good ratings or the Nets might get good ratings, but you know, they don't need the Knicks to get better, but it would really, really help.
I'll tell you, I think that Miami team is terrific, and they're going to be good for a while, just given how young they are. But that market, John, has always just been so weird when it comes to television. Like, it should be a mega market, just given how many people live there, given that it's like an exciting city, given that they're a brand. I mean, they've won championships with D-Wade and LeBron, et cetera. But I'm right about that, right? Miami is just a weird, weird sports television market, correct?
They do okay. They're just sort of like they appear to me to be sort of a mid-sized TV market. I don't think it's one of the cliches is, especially in LA, you know, you take a look at the NFL ratings in LA, there's so many other things to do. You know, if you're in a cold weather city, you're more apt to be stuck inside watching. If you're in Miami, you know, you could go to the beach. There are a ton of outdoor activities that you can do in addition to watching TV, which tends to hurt ratings a little bit.
Yeah, you're right. You're competing against outdoor activity, which makes West Palm, which is always like the number one market, always funny. But that must be just more senior citizens or elderly people, perhaps, who are watching TV. But West Palm is always right. Isn't West Palm always like based on the market and size of the city very, very high in terms of TV?
Yeah, that's not the demo anybody wants, though, right?
Yeah, not the NBA demo. All right, so let's finish up on this. You had a piece on talking to all your buddies at ESPN, John, about ABC now being back in the sports game, at least as a place where ESPN can simulcast some of its inventory. And I think that's really smart, particularly on baseball. You know, like, baseball struggles nationally, certainly in the early rounds, to get viewership. And if you could pop one of those games on ABC, you know, you bring in a network. If you sort of extrapolate this, John, and sort of further it on, this is also clearly the argument that ESPN is going to make to a place like the NFL, where it's like, hey, if we can get in your Super Bowl rotation, we're actually not ESPN. We're ABC/ESPN, and we can bring you, you know, the 100 million homes. But I've always thought that, like, I think ESPN, for a long time, I think they're changing up now. They really didn't use ABC to their benefit. And I'm sure obviously that had to do with Disney, and I'm sure that had to do with scripted programs were the sort of the way of the world until recently. But this feels like, if nothing else, this feels like something that could really be a little bit of a game changer when it comes to viewership, at least in certain events. Do you agree?
Yeah, it happened a couple of times. You know, it's close to being a trend here. I think So there have been sports on ABC where you have Sunday afternoon NBA basketball, you have college football Saturday nights. So that they have stripped out some windows for it. What I found to be interesting about this is that in the Monday Night Football game that opened the Las Vegas stadium, you know, was simulcast across ABC and ESPN. You know, that hadn't happened before. Then we just saw with the wild card round and the baseball playoffs, you know, ABC was part of that rotation. And what had happened in the past is ABC as a broadcast network had a different audience generally than ESPN. ESPN was a young male audience, and ABC was a much more female audience that the ABC executives thought would not watch sports a lot. So it became a place that, you know, ESPN struggled in a lot of ways to find windows that would work on ABC. And what we're seeing now is, and we're going right back to what I said earlier, news and live sports is what's holding the whole TV business together. And you're seeing ABC being much more open and welcome to having, you know, live baseball on in its afternoon hours, or having an NFL game that's going to be simulcast on a, you know, two other channels. ESPN2 as well had it. Well, you know, they found a window for it on ABC. And so this is just something to keep an eye on as ESPN goes out and negotiates new rights deals, as they try to send a message to the NFL that they want to get back in the Super Bowl rotation and they want to be able to keep Monday Night Football. ABC increasingly, it looks like, is going to be playing a part in them.
Interesting. Ja, is there anything else you want to hit on before we get out of here?
What else is good? Let's keep it short and sweet, Rich.
Yeah. By the way, I like the you know how this your employer Sports Business Journal has, when you guys do podcasts, like those primers, don't you keep it to like 7 minutes or something like that? You guys are good at that. Like, you're able to cover a lot of stuff in a very brief amount of time.
Yeah, well, you know, we kind of feel like nobody wants to listen much more than 20 minutes. So that's a commitment. So we just kind of want to get in and get out.
No, well, my next podcast is going to be about 2.5 hours. So there you go. I'm blowing your thesis.
Talking about sports ratings.
Yeah, it's going to be my goal is to make it the longest sports viewership podcast in history, which shouldn't be that hard to do. John Orand is the media reporter for the Sports Business Daily and Sports Business Journal. Check out his work at that publication and on Twitter. And he's part of the excellent newsletter writers that SBJ has, so check out his. When is that? Tuesday, John? Tuesday and Friday, or something like that?
Monday, Wednesday, Rich.
Monday. I could not have been more wrong. Monday and Wednesday is John's dates. All right, John. Thank you as always.
Hey, man. Thanks. Good to be on.
All right. As I said at the top, Stan Van Gundy is an NBA analyst for Turner, TNT, and NBA TV as well. Any basketball fan knows he's the former coach of the Pistons, the Magic, and the Heat. And I'm pleased to be joined by Stan Van Gundy on the Sports Media Podcast. Stan, first of all, thank you for being here, and congrats. You're officially out of the bubble, back into the universe. How does it feel?
Oh, it felt great. You know, the games were great. Broadcasting them was a lot of fun, but the bubble gets a little boring after a while. And it was, for me, what was hard is, you know, I was 40 minutes from my house, but stuck down there. So it seemed like so close, but yet so far. So I am I'm glad to be home.
I can imagine. I want to ask you a couple questions to start about broadcasting inside there. I've talked to both play-by-play people as well as reporters. Mike Breen, Malika Andrews of ESPN happened to be the previous guest on this podcast, and they all sort of have different experiences regarding the challenges of being inside the bubble and the challenges of reporting and the challenges of broadcasting. In your position being an analyst, you're in an empty arena. You're separated most likely by some kind of plexiglass with your play-by-play partner. So these are very, you know, unprecedented, you know, an unprecedented situation for an analyst. What was that specific experience like for you, calling games inside that arena? And what did you find to be the biggest challenge versus what you have normally been used to as a broadcaster?
Well, Well, I think the good thing for me, Richard, was, you know, I hadn't done that many games before. I don't know. Ian and I had maybe done 10 games this year before the, maybe not even that many, before the lockdown. So I hadn't done a lot. And I think that made it easier because I didn't have a big adjustment. I didn't have a lot of experience. What I did see as the challenges were, number one, for me, I can pick up a lot of what's going on the court when I'm down courtside. I can hear coaches call, you know, talking to their players. I can hear play calls, things like that. Couldn't do any of that up above. And then I thought the biggest challenge, but this was more for the play-by-play guys, was trying to bring the energy and emotion to the broadcast. And I worked with three guys, Ian Eagle, Spiro Dedes, and Brian Anderson, and they all did a great job of that. But I thought that was hard because, especially in the playoffs, there's great energy in an NBA arena. And we were working in an environment where it was very sterile, where there was no energy whatsoever. And those guys had to bring the emotion to the broadcast.
Stan, before I get to something else, I did a piece not too long ago for The Athletic with Ian Eagle, Charles Davis, Evan Washburn, and Ian had told me that he had, at that time, I think it was 138 different partners over all the sports he had worked, so obviously you'd be on that list. The thing about Ian that I'm just so impressed by is that he seems to find immediate chemistry with his analyst, regardless of sport, regardless of gender, regardless of who that analyst is. From your perspective as the analyst, why do you think that is? What is it about, you've worked with other play-by-play people, but what is it about Ian where he seems to be able to make it work regardless of who the analyst is?
Yeah, I think it's pretty simple to me. Is Ian is the ultimate team player. You know, I haven't been around sports for a long time and coach. You know, we talk about all the time, you know, put the team first. You want unselfish people. And that's Ian in a nutshell. Like, Ian is not trying to go on a broadcast and promote Ian. Ian is trying to make the broadcast as good as it can possibly be. And that's all that he cares about. And so when all you care about is the success of the broadcast, it's going to make it pretty easy. And then the second thing I think about Ian, I've said this many times, again, the basketball analogy is, you know, we talk about the great players, that what separates them is they make the people around them, the players around them, better. And I know firsthand that Ian does that. You know, he makes everybody around him better. Look, I had virtually no experience. I had done some college games over a period of time before I had gone to Detroit, and a little bit last year. I had done exactly one NBA game on TV before I worked with Ian this year, and he just helped me so much. I mean, number one, he sets you up on the broadcast. But number two, you know, he really mentored me. I mean, he helped me. He taught me. You know, he wasn't afraid to tell me what I was doing wrong in a very encouraging way always. But, you know, do this, don't do that. I mean, just always concerned about making me better. So, he's an outstanding person to work with, the ultimate team guy.
Stan, I realize that you know, certainly challenges of being in the bubble. You're away from home. There's unfamiliarity. But one thing that was unique to you is that your brother was in the bubble. Obviously, everybody certainly listening to this podcast knows Jeff is on the top ESPN team calling the NBA, calling the NBA Finals. And I read a New York Times piece, which was pretty cool, about sort of how you had spent time with Jeff, and you guys would see each other every day. That's not an experience, you know, given your age and Jeff's age, that might normally happen in the course of normal times. So I would sense for you that if there was at least one pretty positive thing about being in the bubble, it was a chance to spend as much time with Jeff on a day-to-day basis that you would, you know, in normal times, not be doing because you guys live in different cities?
That's exactly right. I mean, he lives in Houston. I live here in the Orlando area. We talk, if not every day, pretty close to it. I mean, we're very, very close, but we don't get that many opportunities to see each other. So the chance to just simply get up and walk for an hour, hour and 15 minutes in the mornings when we were down there in the bubble was really a privilege, and certainly made the experience much better for me. You know, as much as I missed being at home and missed my wife, at least I was able to see my brother, who I don't get as much chance to see.
When you and Jeff are walking outside, is Jeff calling out if he sees any referees? Is he getting on their case if they're walking outside with Jeff? Would like to know does it continue off air is what I'm asking you, Stan.
Well, you know what? We're actually in a different bubble. So the players, the referees, and the sideline reporters, the people who come in contact with players and coaches, were in one bubble. And then those of us doing broadcasts, both the on-air people and the crews, were in an entirely different place. So we didn't actually run into any of the referees or anything. But that's a funny question. And would have been good to see, Richard, if we actually did.
You are one of the rare media people, Stan, broadcast media people, who has worked for both ESPN and Turner. For people who don't know, Stan was at ESPN for a year. He was doing mostly studio work. Then joined Turner last year, where he got a schedule of games and was able to call prominent NBA games. Stan has talked about sort of why he made that move, and I think I'm paraphrasing correctly that the Turner offer in terms of scheduling and stuff was better. I am curious though, Stan, because you are in this position. What are the similarities between working at ESPN and Turner, and then what, perhaps more interestingly, what are the differences between working at ESPN and Turner?
Wow, I think that would be probably a pretty individual thing. I can just say from my experience, and it's probably as much as anything from, being very low on the totem pole at ESPN when I was there, and they didn't really have a defined role for me. I thought there this year has been a far more personal interest taken in me and my development in broadcasting at Turner than there was at ESPN. Getting a lot of feedback that has helped make me better. They're interested in, trying to find a schedule that fits. The personal attention has been more. And I'll tell you, a huge difference for me. And some people will look at it positively, maybe some people negatively. But Turner encourages us to be able to speak out on issues that are of importance to us and social issues, where, ESPN actively discourages it, to the point of actually not discouraging it, forbidding it until it became sort of more acceptable to do it. Then ESPN was all in on the social justice movement. But anybody who's followed him knows that, Jimmy Pitaro, right from the top, has actively discouraged people speaking out in favor of social justice and against racial injustice and things like that. And Turner, it's 180 degrees the other way. So that part has been important to me.
All right, so let's talk about that. I'm glad you brought that up. And you are correct. Jimmy Pitaro, to use the expression, made a business decision when he took over to, just so people know, to have a better relationship with the NFL and align himself particularly with that league. Of course, that league was going through a lot of things with Colin Kaepernick. And Pitaro made it very clear that he did not want his on-air talent to be discussing any kind of nexus of politics and sports, politics and social justice, and really made it clear that that was not acceptable especially online. Certainly, I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who would say that was a smart business decision. There are others who would say, you know, why do you hire commentators to be honest with their thoughts and then not let them do that? But as Stan said, he is absolutely correct. That entire thing has changed 180 as of the last couple of months because the ESPN, I would argue, was forced to cover this and forced to change their POV because the world around them changed. It's a little bit of a filibuster, but that sort of brings me into where I want to go here with Stan. Stan, I think anybody who works in good faith would have to acknowledge that the nexus of sports and politics and the nexus of sports and race has always existed. For those who say that there's no politics in sports and no race in sports, you're honestly lying to yourself. You just don't know the history of the United States of America when it comes to sports. That said, one of the things I really appreciate about you, and I think my audience knows this, and I'll certainly say it again, I think we share the same POV when it comes to the current administration. You have been very public on social media about how you feel about the Trump administration, about how you feel about institutional racism in this country. And I think what I've found just really interesting is that you have done this from the beginning of your Turner tenure, and you do it sort of unapologetically. So let's get into that. Did you ever have a discussion with Turner to tell them that, like, I have things that are important to me and I'm going to say this? Or have you just done this, and like you said a couple minutes ago, Turner sort of is just accepting of this as sort of institutionally?
Yeah, I think I just knew that going into, I mean, you know, obviously I have watched Turner, you know, watched him in basketball in particular, but baseball also. You know, I've watched their studio shows. I've watched NBA TV. I've watched, you know, Turner broadcasts. And so I've heard plenty of social comments, maybe not to the degree that you hear them now, but certainly have heard them in the past and, you know, never seen anybody get fired. So I sort of knew that going in. But to be quite honest, Richard, I'm not sure that it would have mattered a whole lot to me. I'm in an enviable position. And look, I understand this is a total position of privilege that not everybody has. But I can easily afford being fired. So even if it did come down to where it cost me my job, these things are important to me, and I would choose speaking out on them over my job. Look, because I'm going to be honest, I think that any employer, and this goes for ESPN, everything else, I pointed out their policies, but any employer has the right to say, you know, no, you're not going to express your opinions on my dime. I mean, if you own a business, you want to control the message that goes out from your business, whether you're the owner of a team or, you know, you run a network or whatever. So I certainly think they have the right to do that. I don't think anybody owes us the right to speak out without any ramifications for our careers. I don't. They can do that and have every right to. But for me, if it came to that, I would simply choose then not to work.
Yeah, I appreciate it. It's an old New York expression, you know. It's good to have fuck you money, basically.
That's exactly right.
Right, yeah. So in getting into that a little bit, let me ask you a couple questions. Where do you stand on what feels like, I don't know if hypocrisy is the right word, but it's certainly a little bit alarming, where on the one hand, NBA owners have absolutely supported the players in terms of messaging on the court, in terms of supporting players, freely speaking their mind about things after and before games. Yet when it comes to their political POVs, they're donating to candidates and campaigns that would seem to go directly against what the players are talking about and the players' interests. This is not every NBA owner, but there are certainly a lot of NBA owners out there.
Yeah, I don't really see it as hypocrisy. I'm going to defend the owners a little bit here. I think it's disappointing to me that that people who are working closely with people of color and hearing their stories, maybe they don't hear them enough, maybe they aren't close enough to the players. It's disappointing that they would continue to hold the views that they have. But I don't see it as hypocrisy in this sense, Richard. I think you certainly have the right to have one point of view and support somebody else's right to speak out on a different point of view. And so I think that's okay. I personally am in the same place a lot of the time. I certainly don't favor blatant hate speech, but I'm pretty liberal, I think, in my thoughts. But I'm a big free speech advocate, and I'm not trying to shut down people on the right's, you know, ability and their right to speak. I don't believe in that. I think that everybody has the right to speak out. And look, when I was in Detroit, I worked for Tom Gores as an owner. I think Tom probably leans a little right of center. He's certainly not a far right guy. But Tom never had a problem, or at least never told me to stop speaking out. I mean, I went on a pretty loud rant the day after the 2016 election, and you know, I heard nothing other than, you know, we support your right to speak out. So I applaud the owners for doing that. Now, the ones who come out, I think where you may be talking about hypocrisy, where certain owners have come out and not only supported the players, but supported the positions themselves, you know, like claim to be allies of, say, the Black Lives Matter movement and all of that. And then we know that their money doesn't support that. That's hypocrisy. But saying, I believe this, but I'm going to support your right to speak out otherwise, and I will have your back on that, I think that's laudable.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's fair. I think there's, and again, anyone can support any candidate. I absolutely respect that, even if I dislike your candidate. I guess for me, where what bothers me is sort of like someone like Stephen Ross, who of the Dolphins, who sort of who preaches one thing, who seems to support one thing, and then is. And then his fundraising for the president of the United States, or at least hosting dinners. But whatever. This again, that's sort of my POV. It doesn't make it right or wrong. It just makes it my POV. One of the things that's interesting, Stan, is you worked for the DeVos family when you were coaching the Magic, and Betsy DeVos, of course, is heads up the Secretary of Education in the United States. I read somewhere that. That you didn't think that you said your criticism was not rooted at all in any experience working for the DeVos family, but you have been very, very clear about how you feel about Betsy DeVos as a education secretary. And I wonder, just sort of again, what has it been like for you to be critical of a family that you used to work for?
Well, I didn't know him well, so I think that makes it a little bit easier. I saw, you know, Richard Sr. More than anybody because they wintered in West Palm and then would come up to games. But, you know, it was a quick hello before the game, and that was about it. I knew when I took the job in Orlando that the DeVosses were conservative. I know they had the one position I knew they took that was in opposition to my beliefs is I knew they had stood against gay marriage here in Florida, going all the way back to the Anita Bryant days. But to be honest, the DeVos family is not very active politically in Florida at all. They don't really spend a lot of time here. Like I said, they spend their, you know, Rich Sr. and Helen spent, you know, their winters in West Palm, but home to them was Grand Rapids, Michigan. And that's where they are really involved. And I knew nothing about their politics in the state of Michigan. Then I go to Detroit and take the job. And you hear about the DeVosses all the time. I mean, they have been absolutely a major force in the destruction of public schools in Michigan, promoted a very right-wing agenda in the state, have thrown a lot of money at Republican politicians there, promoting what I would think are regressive policies. And quite honestly, my wife and I would say to each other all the time, like, it's embarrassing that we worked for these people, and mainly in what they've done to public education. And then to have Betsy DeVos, who I've never met. I know her husband. I know Dick, but I've never met her. But to have her as Secretary of Education, as someone who has really sought to privatize all education, I mean, absolutely against public education of any kind anywhere in this country, is abhorrent to me.
A couple more, Stan, before I let you go here. What we have seen so far in the pandemic, sort of say outside the NFL, which is which is always going to be its sort of own universe and outlier, is sports viewership numbers, generally speaking, have been down. When it you take something like the NHL, 60% down, massively down. Golf tournament, U.S. Open down. If you want to have an honest conversation, as I try to do on this podcast with sports viewership experts, it's never one factor. It's multiple factors. It's the time of the year with a calendar shift for sports fans. It's sports competition going up against other competition. It's the incredible, hyper news cycle where we see all the cable news networks' numbers skyrocketing. And there probably also is something where there's potential for people to have gotten a little bit of sports fatigue because there's so much sports going on now, as well as the fact that you now have a lot of people in homes because of COVID and the television gets shared. So there's no sort of spinning this anywhere other than the viewership numbers for conference finals and NBA finals, Stan, are way, way down. And the NBA finals, we're taping this before the conclusion of it, but unless it goes to game seven and unless something maybe say dramatically changes, the likelihood is it's going to be the lowest viewed NBA finals in 30 plus years for sure. So two-part question for you, Stan. One, what are your sort of overall thoughts on where you see the current popularity of the NBA? And two, do you have any thoughts as to why you think viewership is down specifically in 2020 for the league?
Yeah, I think it's hard, and I think you would agree with this, Richard. It's really hard to read into, the numbers in this really different environment of the pandemic into anything that's going to carry over one way or another, if and when things get back to normal. Like you said, there are so many factors. I also think, with basketball and hockey, it's you're playing when nobody is thinking. I mean, this isn't the time of year. Like your sports clock is off. We're playing basketball when, we would be in training camp right now, for God's sake. So that part of it is weird. I also think what people haven't totally understood is the connection between people in the arena and people watching on TV. The excitement of people going to games, number one, creates more energy and vitality in a broadcast, and that does carry over. Number two, if it's a normal year, I'm living in Orlando, and even if I didn't go to the games, my neighbors went to the games, people are talking about it. It raises my interest in turning on Orlando Magic games, and which also then raises my interest in turning on games in general. I think people have underestimated the effect of fans not being at the games on the popularity of broadcasts. I think there's a big connection there. I think specifically to the NBA, I don't think the popularity is down. I think whenever they're back to having fans, it will happen. And I think probably viewership in the conference finals and the finals being down is probably also attributable to the fact that I haven't been broadcasting those games.
Well, I mean, I didn't want to mention obvious reason.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I was hoping I wouldn't have to say it, that you would say it, but you know, hey, I mean, it's probably a minor factor, but let's not negate it totally.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair, Stan.
And I hope, by the way, that your listeners understand I'm kidding when I say that.
Of course.
Some of your listeners may not know me, but I am definitely kidding when I say that.
Forgetting about those who are going to politicize this for the sake of their own audience and for the sake of, that it's sort of a very easy culture war play. So let's just on both sides. Let's forget about that. In your opinion, understanding where your political POV lies, do you think that the mixture of politics and race and messaging for the NBA, which far and away I think has been a leader in this stuff, do you think any of that has turned off any fans, any viewers? I have my own thoughts on this, but I'll be curious what you have to say.
I'd be surprised if it's turned anybody off from watching in any significant way. Now, that's not to say that there's maybe a lot of fans who don't like it. But I remember, you know, as you do, and you know the numbers better than I do, you know, when this sort of thing sort of got started with Colin Kaepernick taking a knee and, you know, you'd read all this stuff and hear all this stuff. I'm never watching the NFL again, as their viewership and attendance and everything went up. And so people will continue to complain and may not like it, but if you love basketball, you're gonna watch regardless. And if you don't, you're not going to watch. I don't think there's any significant effect on ratings whatsoever. It may affect people's experience with the game, but I don't think it affects whether or not they watch.
Yeah, and again, I would say it certainly, I would never argue that there are people who don't like it. I think it's an honest answer to say I don't like this stuff mixing with my sports. The real question is, how many people statistically are using that as the reason not to watch? And I sometimes, just for fun, like that, I've certainly written this many times, you know, if you want to sort of go on the whole thesis that you are not watching the NFL because you feel like these players have been lecturing to you on this, well, so you to sort of buy that kind of premise, the Bucks and Saints game draws like 23 million. So because it's a great game, you've decided to watch the NFL. But then the Thursday night football team between the Browns and Jets, you're telling me that you didn't watch because you're upset about the NFL's politicization.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, it's a nonsense take. You, if you truly are a true believer in this, you're not watching the league. You're not cherry picking games and then deciding later on, well, you know, I don't like the messaging here, so I'm not going to watch a crappy game. So generally speaking, I'm with you. I think there are 20 factors and 10 factors that certainly could be a factor. I just do not believe it is a statistically dominant factor. The last one I want to ask you is this. This was something that, you know, it's in the wave of in the wave of tweets that we get on a daily basis. It's very rare that a tweet sort of stops me, and I think to myself, wow, that's a pretty ballsy tweet from a broadcaster or from a media person to say. And for you a couple weeks ago, Stan, it was, you talked about what, I'm paraphrasing here, basically the saddest thing about the Trump presidency for you, you said, and again, these are your thoughts, that it was finding people who you liked and who you knew and who you respected, including people in the league, including people you coached with, who were supporting someone you believe is racist and narcissistic and misogynistic. Do you remember tweeting that? I'm not going to ask you who you're referring to in the league, but I don't know. I was sort of struck by that, because it's one thing to sort of say what you feel, but it's another thing when you personalize it to talk about your relationships and the people around you and how that's really disappointed you. Because I do think there's probably a lot of people who share your sentiment if they're people who don't particularly like this president.
Yeah, but I want to make a couple of points. Number one, I think that tweet probably resonated with people more on an emotional level than anything that I've sent out. You know, because I do think a lot of people have gone through that. But the only thing I you know, regret a little bit, and it's hard on Twitter because you're limited in space, but, you know, I didn't make the distinction between Trump voters and Trump supporters. And I, you know, to me, that's important. So I understand that there are people out there who will say, yeah, this guy drives me crazy. I know he's a racist and I don't like his comments about women, but I just think overall Republican policies are better for our country than Democratic policies. I get that. And those aren't the people that I'm talking about. It still may disappoint me a little because of my own point of view, but I don't look at them personally any differently. I'm talking about the people who think this guy is great, who support him no matter what he does. And so he can say in a debate about the Proud Boys, stand back and stand by, and they think that's great. That he can tell people, don't worry about the coronavirus, and people think that's great. That those are the people that I know that support him. I mean, really support him. Those are the people I'm talking about. And it disappoints me because those people are saying to me, I share Donald Trump's values. That's different for me than just making a choice in terms of voting. A lot different, because certainly over my lifetime, Richard, and I'm sure most people can say the same, I will vote for people that I don't share a lot of their values, but I think that overall they're just a better person to vote for in that race. And I think there's a huge difference. That's who I meant to be talking about. I didn't make that clear in that tweet, and I regret that a little bit.
I appreciate you spelling it out. And again, I'm someone who's voted. I've voted GOP in my life. I voted Democratic in my life. And so I do, I appreciate you sort of saying that, because at least for me, I'm only speaking for me. A lot of what I feel is very specific to a singular person and a singular administration. And so I can relate to the sort of the sentiment of what that tweet was, because I certainly have some friends and family members who I'm just stunned that they support something that, at least in my experience with them personally, is not something I thought they supported. And, you know, we'll see, Stan, how many people I lose on this podcast.
Well, no, Richard, for me, it's been personalized, with my dad. My dad's 85 years old,
right.
And very, very conservative in his politics. And he'll openly acknowledge disgust at the things that Donald Trump voices, on racial issues. My dad voted for Amendment 4 in Florida to restore the right to vote to people who have finished their sentences. I mean, my dad has solid values in terms of racial justice and equal rights and things like that. But my dad, at the same time, can never bring himself to vote Democratic, or very, very rarely. So he'll either have to vote for whoever the Republican candidate is, or in the case of Donald Trump, he'll have to vote third party, which doesn't make sense to me, but that's different. I mean, I know that my father does not, share the values of racism and xenophobia and those things. He's making a political decision based on other issues that he thinks are important. As much as I can argue with that, I can't personalize that, and doesn't change my feelings at all for my father. But it, like I say, it's the people who support all the stuff he says. You know, he's right. That stuff, no, I don't have sympathy for that. I still support your freedom to express it, but yeah, it changes my views of you as a person, and I probably don't want to spend time dealing with you, quite honestly, if those are the values that you hold dear.
Stan Van Gundy is a NBA analyst for Turner Sports and an NBA TV. He's always interesting to listen to when he's on a broadcast. And as I've said, I think in print as and certainly on this podcast, I appreciate him. I just appreciate him being as forthright and honest as in his feelings on how he feels about the state of the country. Obviously, we share a POV on a lot of that stuff, so I don't want to bullshit you who are listening. At the same time, it is something I respect because it's not something you see a lot of broadcasters do. Stan, I wish you nothing but continued success in broadcasting. Thanks for giving me a little bit of time today, and welcome back home.
Thanks, Richard. I appreciate it.
All right, back in the studio to wrap up. My thanks to John Orand and Stan Van Gundy for their insights and for their conversation. If you like these kind of discussions, if you like this kind of content, head to the Sports Media with Richard Deitch archives. Leave us a 5-star review and a nice note, if you could, on those reviews. That's how the podcast continues. The archives, at least the latest ones, have ESPN's Malika Andrews on reporting 4 months inside the NBA bubble. Prior to that, writing critically on Kobe Bryant with Jeff Perlman, the author of Three Ring Circus, and Donovan Bennett on the differences between U.S. and Canada sports media. Jim Trotter and Steve Weish of NFL Media were recent guests on this podcast, along with Kavitha Davidson and Jessica Luther. Broadcaster Renee Paquette, better known as Renee Young in the WWE. You can check her episode out there. For that, Tanya Ganguly of the LA Times, ESPN's Holly Rowe, ESPN's Stefano Fasaro on being parts of their bubble. James Andrew Miller was a guest, and just J.A. Donde. Just you can go through the archives and hopefully find something that you like. My producers again are Patrick Antonetti and Sean Cherry. Thanks to everybody at Cadence 13, from Chris Corcoran to Spencer Brown to John McDermott. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Media Podcast.